Okay, so basically, I didn't really know exactly the audience, but essentially, we have been working, for those of us that have been working in HPV for several decades, in looking for ways that we could utilize HPV as a, in screening as a secondary prevention, and we have the opportunity to look now at HPV prevention through vaccination. And this is a slide from New Mexico that shows rates that are age-adjusted to the 1970 U.S. standard. And basically, the reason I show you this is just to show you that when I arrived in New Mexico, there were large disparities between American Indian, Hispanic, and non-Hispanic white incidence rates for cervical cancer. And after the breast and cervical cancer screening program and our state and Indian Health Service got together, this isn't really a reflection of current day, but we're about 8 per 100,000 women cases of invasive cervical cancer. And those disparities that were largely due to a lack of screening between ethnic groups have virtually disappeared. There is still differences in the mortality between the ethnic groups, principally because of residents in rural areas. These data you are all familiar with. The reason that I point them out is just to show you that in some ways we're dealing with, if you think about cervical intraepithelial neoplasia grade 2, 3, and adenocarcinoma in situ, and you look at the effectiveness or efficacy of the vaccines in a per-protocol population, you have a very high efficacy. And that drops when you are considering an intention-to-treat population, and if you consider any HPV type, not just HPV 16 and 18, it drops even further. So right now, as we move into vaccinating populations, we have adolescents that would, or early sexual activity that would represent a per-protocol population, so highly effective. But we also have women being vaccinated that are already infected with HPVs, and so the efficacy in those populations is going to probably be lower. But we're going to be evaluating all of this in real time. So I wasn't educated in PowerPoint making. I could never fit a small amount on one slide. Or I refuse to follow the directions. Okay, so what really we're interested in is measuring effectiveness of HPV vaccines outside of clinical trial in the real world. And what will become of importance ultimately after vaccine is implemented for a while is the residual vaccine and non-vaccine types that will represent our targets for what we're screening for, and it will represent the costs of screening and treatment. And we believe, or I believe, that in doing this analysis, what we want to be concerned with is the genotypes that are circulating in normal women and in abnormal Paps. From what I have been able to observe in an analysis that was covering 99% of the population cases of CIN23 from 1995 to the year 2000, you can even see during that time period and the 5 years preceding it that as we have become better at screening, even in the last decade, HPV 16 prevalence in CIN23 has declined, even in the last 10 years. So if we take snapshots of just CIN23, we're going to have a hard time, I think, sorting things out. We want to know HPV type-specific reductions in costly diagnosis of ASCUS and LSIL. We don't just want to know what reductions in CIN23 we have. In our lifetime, we are not going to probably see reductions in cancer, and we will only begin to see impact on CIN23 or high-grade abnormalities. I think that it will be important for us to understand circulating viruses in the population, because it will be the only way that we will have a way of disentangling a unmasking of co-infections that may occur in at-risk women versus HPV type replacement. So basically, we have all these types, and we don't believe that we will have replacement based on various biologies, biological phenomenon, but we very well may have simple unmasking. People who have other non-vaccine types that will get disease possibly from remaining HPV types. So we in New Mexico developed a PAP, what we call the HPV PAP registry, and it's a partnership between the Department of Health, the University of New Mexico, and local, national, and federal organizations. And it's overseen by a steering committee, which was agreed to as the oversight structure by the Department of Health. The registry was conceived because we believed that the surveillance was important, given that there are many changes that will be overlapping both in screening and in vaccination. And we want to understand both provider and patient practices as these changes are put forth. So in New Mexico, we changed the administrative code in April of 2006, and this shows exactly what the regulation states in its short form. Basically, laboratories, not providers, laboratories report to the registry, and they report all PAP tests, all cervical pathology, and all HPV tests. Because different computer systems allow different things, some laboratories report to us all GYN. Okay, so it's just easier for them, and we do the parsing of the body part locally. The goals of the registry are to maintain a statewide woman-based information system that can compile cervical cancer screening and diagnostic histories. And we want to characterize cervical cancer screening behaviors, diagnostic and treatment services, interval practices and outcomes, and cost effectiveness by race, ethnicity, age, and geographic area. We plan on linkages to our state immunization information system, and we also will conduct linkages to health plan and other billing data. We agree that the resource under the steering committee approval, with a very specific process in place, can allow the conduct of research under IRB approval within the context of the registry. About 50% of our state laboratories provided us data back to 2001. So for 50% of the state, we have historical data that goes from 2001 now to 2008, and it allowed us to see very specific changes. For example, when we looked at Bethesda 2001 implementation, you could see the appearance, obviously, of ASCH diagnosis. Then you could see the implementation of liquid cytology with the increase in LSIL and a decrease in unsatisfactories. And then you saw the implementation of SurePath media over, for example, thin prep media, and a further decrease in unsatisfactories. So you can see exactly what's happening in practice with these data. If you only had data from 2006, you couldn't see any of that. But it gives you an idea of the sensitivity for what you're able to detect in the population. These are the information that we collect. The different slide preparation method, we designate whether it's conventional or liquid. 90% of our state is liquid cytology. Pap smears are classified under Bethesda. All the histology diagnoses are collected, and it's collected as a field that is, we collect all codes, but a field that is complete dictated text, and then a dictionary sort of extracted diagnosis. We also collect all of the HPV results, which right now is just hybrid capture too, but we've built in flexibility in our reporting for the few people who go out and do genotyping here and there. We collect date of birth, social security number, address, and various provider demographics, various medical identification numbers. And then you can see a bunch of different things we collect in terms of obvious things, date of specimen collection or service, test description, clinical history, laboratory data source, ordering physician, et cetera. You can see the codes. And then we assign a unique study identification numbers and sequence numbers and the record date that this information is loaded into our registry. And I'm going to show you some of the linkage data that we've been able to do given the population of data that we've collected. Our population in New Mexico is about 1.9 million, and there's about 640,000 PAP-eligible women. We collected 1.5 million records for our initial capture, including the data back to 2001. We actually got from that capture of 5 years a population of 610,000 individual women. Using that data, which is, it's not perfect, we'll be able in the future to actually say what the screening population is. But taking those women, our data say that 42% of women screen every year or screen annually, and that in 2 years, only 62% of the population was screening. So that's a little bit less than what is estimated through BRFSS. This is what our state looks like to give you a little bit of an idea. Here's Albuquerque, and that's the population center. There's about 700,000 people who live in this area. And then if I'm going to a laboratory over here in Silver City, that takes me 5 hours to get there. If I'm going to Roswell, that's a little bit over 3 hours. And all of the hearts you see are laboratories where we're collecting specimens from. So this registry is one aspect of what we're doing, but we're also collecting residual liquid cytology specimens and paraffin-embedded blocks. So this is an overview of the laboratories. This was old, I didn't make a new one, but essentially we collect from individual laboratories in the state, but we also collect from Quest and LabCorp, Ameripath, specialty labs, anybody who's holding data for New Mexico. We capture all data electronically. The only place that I take data from that's on paper is in Taos, because I just cannot justify making the pathologist in the hospital go through for the small number of volume that they do. But everyone's reporting electronically. Most of it happens through secure FTP. Then we basically capture the data and put it into an application server that it's moved off of. It goes into a staging database where a lot of programming happens before it gets put into the programming database. This is to give you an actual picture of some of the data that we have collected. So this is 2007, and it gives you an idea of how I can get 90% of the cervical pathology in 5 laboratories within our state. So there's about 12,500 cervical biopsies, representing about 90% of the state, the total including all outside laboratories. So people tend to do their pathology in state. If they're not doing something, it's that they don't keep a cytotech. But pathologists are staffing hospitals. Okay, here's the PAP test. 250,000 PAP tests are done per year that we've captured. And we can see, because we get monthly or every 2 week reporting, I'm sorry about the telephone. Basically, we can see the consistency of the numbers reported per month per lab, and if somebody changes their arrangement, we can see the volume go wherever it goes. So we've been able to do that over the last 2 years. So we believe that we are now collecting over 95% of the state after digging around in Texas a little bit. This is, those Texans, they get you wherever you're going. So this is a data that we took our women, in this case, we took women who were in our database from 2006 and 2007 and looked for if we found a biopsy for those women based on their PAP diagnosis. So you can see that this is kind of interesting, and actually nobody has ever shown, to my knowledge, population-based data that is out of a healthcare organization, i.e., this is a population of 250,000 women who had abnormal PAP diagnoses, and where are their biopsies? Well, you can see that not everybody gets biopsies, and you can see this constant sort of curve after the initial beating them out of the woodwork happens in the clinic. You have the residual noncompliance plus the failure of providers to continue to try and capture those women. If you look at this next slide, though, I could say, oh my God, the reviewers of this are going to say, they can't match women. But if I have a biopsy for a woman, I can find her PAP, her referral PAP, and this is what this slide shows. We took the last 6 months of biopsies in our database and looked for the referral PAP, and you can see that we capture all of the referral PAP smears pretty much. Basically, we have done this baseline, and we are now doing type-specific determinations. In liquid cytology, we're doing a sample of 60,000 women. It is comprised of 45,000 randomly selected normal women and 15,000 abnormals. We're collecting paraffin-embedded tissues, about 4,500 CIN2s, which equal 80% of the cases occurring 2006 to 2009, and 5,500 CIN1s, which are about half of them from 2006 and 2007. We're going to link to the immunization registry, as I said, and to other databases, including billing and health plan data, and we're overseen by a steering committee, and anybody. I didn't really want to be the gatekeeper. So basically, there's a steering committee of 20 people to which anyone can submit proposals to. So I say that our added value is that in New Mexico, we have long-term surveillance. We're one of the SEER sites for the U.S. We have a lot of epidemiology and HPV lab experience. We have a strong statewide collaborative environment. We have invested significant amount of local funds. And our steering committee is comprised of national and international experts. So the last line is what you should all pay attention to. We're looking for money to keep this resource together. The money that we put in here to make this go is for over $500,000 per year, and it's not going to continue without external funding. So thank you. Right, but what are those data based on? In other words, the data that's in the literature is either study data or HMO-based data. I mean, I talked to Walter Kinney, and he said, actually, that data looks like what Kaiser looked like before they went into recall system and, like, flagging everything, because essentially it doesn't happen without beating people out of the woodwork. So they have special recall now, but when they first looked at it, he said that would not be, I mean, I went going, what am I supposed to be seeing, right? I can only say that I can have some problems with linkages, right? I know because I had to do this to put a grant application in, and we haven't refined it. But on the other hand, I know that I can do other kinds of linkages that don't show me that I'm not going to get that much better. So let's pretend I'm going to get 8% better. That's not going to fix the problem that I don't have women getting biopsies from abnormal Paps. I agree. Believe me, I was like, should I show them that data? I know, but I can't really say anything until we study it more. Like, you do understand one of the problems in our state is the rural reality and our poverty level. We're the second or third poorest state in the country. And so it wouldn't be that surprising to me that if after 90 days you don't show up and you get a letter sent somewhere, the medical liability is gone and that's the end of the story. I only know that from being in this system for a long time. I know that BCCP, so our breast and cervical cancer program, meets a quality standard, which is for that follow-up, under 3% loss to follow-up for a colposcopy following an abnormality that's appropriate. But BCCP in my state serves 3,000 women. So I can only say, like I said, should I show, not you guys, but should I submit that? Because it really could be the truth. It could be the truth. I don't think it's, like I said, I don't think it's going to, even when I improve on my matching, I don't think all of a sudden it's going to be, oh, there is all fixed. Because that's in part probably a matching deficit, right? I haven't had time to use all of the different matching things or even play with the parameters. You know, we've done very straightforward manipulations, but I can find people, their referral Paps who get biopsies, which, I mean, I get 90%, I get a curve that you would expect in terms of the referral for those biopsies, but I don't get the reverse. Yeah, but that's the data I have. Yes, but I can't, I haven't been able to deal with the data. Because I would remove non-biopsies and I would remove a lot of things, no. But in general, I still don't think it's going to be, from knowing who doesn't get biopsied, that it's going to improve to 75% in, let's say, 120 days. I don't think it will. It looks abysmal, but what can I say? I showed it to you. I shouldn't have.
I'm from Philadelphia. I'm in Southeast Pennsylvania. And I think what you're showing is not very different from anywhere else in the country, quite frankly, given that women who are poor but not poor enough to get medical assistance don't have the resources to go for the follow-up care. So you can send them. Services, we can't afford to carve out money for that service that we
I really think the data are closer to correct than we can unfortunately admit. And I think that we've never seen population-based data before. I expect I can improve somewhat on the matching, but I know that people in my state, actually just in my populations that I've worked with, that they're high risk, people who often basically are afraid of the diagnosis, even with an abnormality for a colposcopy. And if they've had a colposcopy once before, they may not want to come back. I mean, meaning extends beyond just money. I can't really say anything, but I will try and improve my matching. It's the only thing I can do. I mean, I will try to study what the issues are, but that's the data I have at the moment. So the data's correct. See, you heard it from her.
It's been replicated.